Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up today, a California lawmaker heads to the Mexico border. Hear his remarks. But first, the devastation to the citrus crop in Texas. I'm talking with an industry leader on the issues growers are facing. And that is today's My Ag Life in Citrus.
My Ag Life in Citrus is brought to you by Soil and Crop Incorporated, your number one resource for sustainable crop nutrition by putting nature to work for you.
Texas is the third top citrus state in the nation after Florida and California. And in the last year, growers have had a lot of troubles. Dale Murden is a Texas citrus grower and president of Texas Citrus Mutual, and he joins us now to share his insights.
Texas has been through an awful lot lately, and citrus has been through a lot lately. So I'm not even sure where the best place is to start. How are things?
Yeah, you know, we were on that call with DC, and it occurred to me that exactly 1 year ago, about right now, I was in DC at the USDA building when the city started shutting down to COVID. Now fast forward a year. In that 11, 12 month period in Texas, we've had extreme drought lingering. It's still here. We had Hurricane Hannah in July, lost about 20% of the crop estimated at that time. And then, we started our season off in October. In spite of the hurricane and drought, we were having a pretty good year. And then the St. Valentine's Massacre hit, and the rest is history. All that on top of the pandemic that you know, we've all been trying to deal with on various levels. So the freeze. You know, we, unfortunately, February and March for citrus growers is a horrible time because we're not only trying to finish up our existing crop, but we're just starting to bloom and grow our next year's crop. So our estimates, our industry estimates that we've given to both the federal and state officials are, we lost the remainder of the crop on the trees. That was about 55% of our grapefruit crop was remaining, and about 98% of our late orange crop was remaining. So estimates combining those two together, that loss is about $80 million. Then you start to estimate the loss of your next year's crop. We feel like we've used a conservative figure of 75% loss, and that could arguably be 100%, but you know, we're trying to be conservative with our guesstimates because that's what they are. But that's another $225 million. Not having a crop next year is the real blow. Then we start to assess tree damage. That after, 3 weeks now, is starting to become a little clearer. Texas had been in a pretty extensive replanting program. In the last several years, we've replanted some 4,000 or 5,000 acres of citrus. Well, it looks like the 1 to 2 year old trees, you know, 1,500 acres or more, they didn't make it, and those will die. I mean, I guess you could conservatively estimate that at about $10 million. Our older trees at the moment look like there's probably hope, starting to see some flushing out and some growth. Although, you know, anytime after a freeze, you're still going to have to cut back a lot of dead wood, which is going to affect that next year's crop we're talking about. So in a nutshell, that's kind of where we're at, Sabrina.
That's probably plenty for people to handle, I think. I don't even know how you can laugh right now.
Well, believe me, 2 weeks ago, I wasn't laughing. And in Texas, you're not really sure what happened, but the power issues and the water issues, I'm sure y'all all saw, were very real and very problematic. I'm one of the older growers now, I guess. Unfortunately, I've my career started right about the time we had the 1983 freeze. And for us, the 1983 and then 6 years later, the 1989 freezes, those were tree killers like instantly. Mm-hmm. You knew what was happening after those freezes. We got down into the teens then for days. It was unreal. And of course, that was just when I was getting started. So we've been around, but we've always bounced back, and we've always bounced back better. After the 83 freeze, we took the initiative. Back then, we were a pink ruby red grapefruit. Now we're that pretty dark red grapefruit you see everywhere because of that 83 freeze. So we've always taken advantage of a disaster to come back stronger, you know, different techniques, different varieties, et cetera. You know, we may be smaller, but we're stronger and smarter. And that's just kind of how it works here in Texas. And this won't be any different. We'll come back. It's just going, you know, it's like I've been talking to folks, consumers. I'm a grower. You fight for shelf space. That's always a concern because there's just so many commodities now that consumers like. And you hope that they remembered that they liked your product when you make your way back to the shelf space.
Freeze is a killer for citrus, as we know. I mean, and I like that you pointed out, it's not just the oranges that were still on the tree. We're talking about, we've got next year's crop starting, but then also the tree damage. I wanted to ask you about that because freeze can kill off the trees. Is there anything that can be done for the freeze damaged trees? That can they be brought back? Is there methods that can be used by the growers?
You know, prior to the freeze, you know, we do a lot of micro sprinkler irrigation, and you can freeze a tree and insulate it for a few degrees inside. It's not going to save your crop, but you can save your tree. One of the problems we had with this particular freeze was the wind was just howling out of the north. So placement of your sprinkler systems was an issue, and it was just very, very difficult. There's been some that were successful with it, others not so much. And I mean, you've got pictures of where the water was trying to stay on the tree, but the wind was just is brutal. You know, when you have those kind of conditions, you can't use smoke or anything like that, those radiational type freezes to try to protect yourself that I know we used to be able to do. When it comes in blowing like that for, I guess we were at 21 degrees for 4 hours straight, but over 50 hours below freezing. And as y'all know, anything under 28 degrees for the fruit's a problem. Anything under 26 degrees starts to become a problem for the tree itself. And we were there. You know, looking at it now, I mean, if we managed to recover our older trees, we probably got off lucky. Hard to say when you're losing basically a crop and a half, and you're still going to have all that expense going into it, whether you have any income or not. But hey, if I got a tree to build on 2 years from now, I'm ahead.
And that was the next thing I wanted to talk about. Farmers are resilient. They have to be. You have to be. And I imagine probably in Texas, they're tougher than many. So how do you come back? And is there help for the growers out there who have had these big losses? And as you pointed out, just a continual year of hit after hit after hit.
You know,
what kind of help is there?
Yeah, citrus is one of the crops. We do have crop insurance and we do have tree insurance. Those products are good, but in a disaster of this magnitude, they're far from stopping the hemorrhaging. You know, as an example, I might recover $1,500 an acre from a crop insurance policy, depending on my level of coverage. But Sabrina, my expenses are easily $3,500 an acre, whether I'm growing that crop or not. And so, you know, we do. Folks like Casey and Mike Sparks and Matt Joyner over in Florida, we look to federal disaster programs, things like WHIP and those things that we're just now investigating that we can hope help growers, because citrus is such a long-term investment. You know, let's say I'm wiped out and I want to get back in the game. You know, you're probably waiting a couple of years for trees because everybody wants trees, so you're behind on getting the tree. So let's just argue for a minute that you're 2 years away from getting the tree. By the time you plant it, another 3 to 5 years before you start seeing any income back. It's not a young man's game anymore. It starts to get real serious, especially when you're my age. You kind of wonder why you would do it. So we'll hope that those older trees, we can get back into production quicker as we start to begin to replant new ones.
And can you remind me again about how much of the crop did you say was still on the trees when the freeze happened?
Yeah, so 55% of our grapefruit crop was remaining and 98% of our late orange crop was remaining.
That's a huge loss to suffer.
You know, I guess that, Yeah, I mean, that's a tough blow for sure. We were having a good year. Prices were up, quality was good, size was good. Everything seemed to be falling into place. Vitamin C is actually sought after right now for all the wrong reasons, but nevertheless, it is what it is. It's that losing next year's crop that's the blow. Anytime you have hints of a freeze in February and March as a grower, your heart starts to sink a little bit. That's what happened.
All right. Do you have any final thoughts or anything else that you would like for our listeners to know about Texas citrus?
You know, like anything, I think we're proud of the fact that we're the fresh grapefruit growers. Can't say enough good about my counterparts at California Citrus Mutual and Florida Citrus Mutual. We're a tight bunch. We stick together and we have to, we need to. And it's nice to be supported. You know, I know right after the freeze, I had folks reaching out from all over the country. Your California growers were reaching out. Florida growers were reaching out. You know, they get it. And it's nice to know that you're thought of and you got that support system there.
Thank you again to Dale Murden, president of Texas Citrus Mutual. Your news brief is coming up next. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Here's your news brief for today. The USDA is requesting public input on a climate-smart agriculture and forestry strategy. They say it represents an important step toward implementing President Biden's executive order on tackling the climate crisis at home and abroad. That order states that America's farmers, ranchers, and forest landowners have an important role to play in combating the climate crisis and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by sequestering carbon in soils, grasses, trees, and other vegetation, and sourcing sustainable bioproducts and fuels. The order directs Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack to solicit input from stakeholders as USDA develops a climate-smart agriculture and forestry approach. Meanwhile, the Agriculture Secretary believes climate-smart agriculture innovations and practices could provide new market opportunities for ag producers. Here's Rod Bain with more.
As more agricultural producers are also earning off-farm income to make a living on the farm, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack believes there are ways to reverse this trend.
If we're going to turn things around, it's going to be necessary for us in agriculture to work creatively and innovatively to create new market opportunities, new sources of income, new revenue streams for farmers so that they are not just solely dependent on the sale of commodities.
To that end, the secretary sees climate-smart agriculture as an avenue for such opportunities. At the recent National Farmers Union National Virtual Convention, he offered three examples. First,
there is the opportunity to sequester carbon. And to do that, we need to create financial incentives and markets that are not designed and structured for an investment class, but are designed and constructed and implemented for farmers.
Meanwhile, new technologies can convert ag waste to products such as chemicals, fibers, and fabrics.
This too creates a new opportunity, a new revenue stream, the potential for dairy operations, for example, to reclaim water from the manure for their operations, to extract from it organic materials that can be used in organic farming and then pelletize essentially the remaining solids into a nutrient that can be stored and packaged and transported around the world.
As for a third market that could arise from climate smart agriculture,
there's the opportunity to continue to collect and to reuse methane from livestock operations that will allow us to add to the renewable fuel and energy mix of this country.
Secretary Vilsack says USDA's role in developing these new markets involves providing resources to make such markets happen and to expand their potential opportunities to producers. At the same time,
we obviously have to use traditional programs that already exist, EQIP, CSP, CRP, REAP, RCPP, in ways that will allow us to expand significantly and to invest in and to incent climate smart agricultural practices and regenerative practices. All of that can create, I think, support and new revenue sources for farmers.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Mission Produce and its partner, Mr. Avocado, announced Monday the first ever shipment of California avocados to China. They say market access of avocados to China from California is due to years of coordination, negotiation, and planning between the California Avocado Commission, the United States Department of Agriculture, and the government of China. Transit time from California to China is the fastest currently available for avocados, taking about 2 weeks by vessel and 1 day by air. Mission and Mr. Avocado are the only shippers and receivers in China with one brand from multiple growing countries and have been in partnership since 2017. We heard earlier about what citrus growers in Texas are facing. The winter storm that blasted through Texas did a lot of damage to food producers. But will it affect prices for consumers? Here's Gary Crawford.
When President Biden visited Texas to view firsthand the devastation from that deadly winter storm in mid-February, he said,
"When a crisis hits our states, like the one that hit Texas, it's not a Republican or Democrat who's hurting. It's our fellow Americans who are hurting."
And indeed, in the agricultural sector of Texas,
everybody's hurting. It just depends on which way, shape, or form it is.
Justin Hale, an agricultural extension agent in north central Texas, and what he says is true for most of the Lone Star State.
It was pretty devastating for our farmers and ranchers.
Texas A&M AgriLife Extension economist Dr. Jeff Hyde, and he says that storm caused damage to
facilities, equipment, animals, crops.
You name it. Now, by the time you hear this, the dollar figure estimates of losses to the Texas agricultural sector may be higher, but the early assessments that came out last week put the overall ag losses at about $600
million. $230 million affecting the citrus crops, $228 million for livestock, and $150 million for vegetable crops.
But Jeff Hyde told us once again, don't carve that loss assessment in stone.
That's an initial estimate, and I would consider that conservative in almost all cases, because in some cases we've got to wait and see what the lingering impacts are going to be.
For example, in the citrus arena, yes, we already know what crops were destroyed. The big question is,
were the trees damaged or just the crop? And it may be a bit of time before we learn how badly the trees themselves were damaged.
And also, when we went to press with this report, the damage assessment for the 4,000 or so Texas nursery landscape businesses had not even been done yet. Now, of course, Texas is also a huge livestock state. Those producers had to deal with deaths of all types of livestock, plus damage to poultry houses, huge heating costs, if heat was available at all, and the storm certainly did a number on the dairy industry.
I think one of the key losses there was due to transportation issues, and so there was a real challenge here in the state while roads were poor for trucks to pick up and deliver milk for processing. And so there was an awful lot of milk dumped.
At one point, Texas dairies were dumping about $8 million worth of milk every day. So those are just a few examples of how the storm affected farmers in Texas. But how will the aftermath affect food prices at the supermarket? We asked USDA economist Carolyn Chelius about that, and she doesn't seem to think there will be much effect on retail prices or supplies, except maybe for one product.
The product to be most concerned about would be grapefruit, because Texas produces about a third of the U.S. supply of grapefruit, and a significant portion of the grapefruit crop was damaged in the storm.
But Carolyn says based on last week's early loss numbers, there should not be significant price hikes for most foods. However, as Jeff Hyde told us, as far as the estimate for losses,
that number will get bigger as we learn more.
Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's your news brief for today. When we come back, a California lawmaker takes on President Biden's border policies. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Welcome back. As the House of Representatives prepares to take up immigration legislation this week, House Minority Leader Republican Kevin McCarthy of California led a group of representatives and others who visited the Mexican border Monday near El Paso, Texas. They met with reporters with a message against President Biden's handling of border security and illegal immigration. Here is the opening message McCarthy gave.
Thank you all for coming. I want to start first by thanking Chief Gloria Chavez with the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol. And I want to thank every man and woman for the Border Patrol for the exceptional job they're doing and under extraordinary times. Their attitude, their work was exceptional. The security of our nation and our border is first and foremost the responsibility of our president. I came down here because I heard of the crisis. It's more than a crisis. This is a human heartbreak. The sad part about all of this, it didn't have to happen. This crisis is created by the presidential policies of this new administration. There's no other way to claim it than a Biden border crisis. Every part of what we sat and talked to, we learned more of how it was created. Congressman Menendez, talked to a family from Honduras, asked how long they've been traveling, 22 days. Just in coincidence of the actions taken by President Biden of why people think they could come here and break the law. We went through a new facility that was built just more than a year ago. They built it with a capacity they thought they could never meet, 1,040 people to be processed. Today broke that record. Today they're beyond capacity. They're having to build into the parking lot a makeshift facility. Even though the U.S. Congress just passed a $1.9 trillion bill, not $1 in there to help them. It's taking away the operation cost for the border to be protected. But for all these children that are unaccompanied that's sitting in there, there's 120 border agents that are now inside that unit that are not on the border protecting us when a surge is coming. As we went up to Monument 3, speaking to the men and women on the front lines, they catch from 100 to 200 people a night. As we talk to the medical units, and as I tell you, as not as a member of Congress, but as a father of a son and a daughter, and you look in the eyes of these children, they came unaccompanied. They tell the story of a 1, a 3, and a 5-year-old holding their hands, walking up to an agent with no parents, no adults in sight. Who brought them? When you talk to the medical units, talk about the percentage that get trafficked, that get harmed along the way. Who knows what dangers and who doesn't make it? All because the policies of our president has changed and told them something different. Told them to risk their lives and broke families apart. We are better as a nation than this. This is about the safety and security of our border, but it's also about the opportunity that Americans want and the prosperity. I know the president's going to travel this week. This is where he should bring Air Force One. This is where he should look the people in the eye. This is where he should talk to the border agents and let them know that this is beyond a crisis. He can continue to deny it, but the only way to solve it is to first admit what he has done And if he will not reverse action, it's going to take congressional action to do it. And that's why we're here. We want to find solutions. Before we even came here, I sent a letter to the president to work together to solve this problem. I thought maybe he would reach out. Maybe he'd set an appointment. He doesn't even acknowledge a letter, let alone a crisis that his policies created. So we will work together, across the aisle, within our own party, because we know the solutions that it will take. When you talk about what's coming across, I just left a few border agents and I asked them, who are the individuals you're catching? Yeah, they're from Central America. But you know who else? Iran, Yemen, Sri Lanka. When I walked through the facility, there's more Haitians than any other nationality I saw. And why were they coming now? You ask the border agents, they were shocked themselves because they're being released into the country. When I talked to the doctor to see when they're being tested for COVID, when they get out, more than 10% are testing positive. Well, you're being stored together. In a time when the president will keep our country closed, one maybe we have hope for a 4th of July to get together just with our family, how much spread of COVID is he creating every single day by his policies along this border? It's wrong, and it has to end, and it needs to end now.
Later, Representative McCarthy made the distinction between Border Patrol and immigration.
And don't misconfuse border security with immigration. They're two separate. Right now we have a border that is not secure. Right now we know drugs. We know terrorists. We know what's happening to unaccompanied children coming across. The right way is to have a system that can work, that you don't wait forever. A right way to have a system that I believe fundamentally, even when you're talking about an education, when somebody's here, they get an engineering degree and others, then we tell them to go away and compete against us. I'm going to celebrate because every family's a family of immigrants. April 23rd of this year will be the 100th anniversary of my grandfather coming from Italy and landing on Ellis Island. He came with his mother. He applied. He had somebody who sponsored him. He went to work, his father, his mother. This is a system that we have to keep families together. I don't think we should put the married brothers and the others, but let's make a system that actually works. Put it on merit. Have the ability to come. I believe, just as Republicans, when we were in the majority, we offered two different bills for immigration reform. The Democrats held back every single vote instead of moving it forward to the Senate. They'd rather have it for a political ploy. We can solve the immigration problem, but don't confuse a border crisis with an immigration problem. Those are different. Thank you very much for coming.
At just about the same time as McCarthy's news conference, the daily White House press briefing was underway. Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about the situation at the border.
Given how fast-moving the situation has been, does the president believe that his administration has a handle on what's happening on the southern border right now?
We certainly do. And let me just give you a bit of an update on a couple of the steps that we're taking. First, let me say that, like COVID, obviously a different issue, but we recognize this is a big problem. The last administration left us a dismantled and unworkable system. And like any other problem, we are going to do everything we can to solve it. So our focus here is on solutions. Let me just walk you through a couple of the steps. And we've done this a little bit, but there's always, of course, developments on considerations that are underway. First, we've updated, or we have not, but CDC has updated guidelines to return to full capacity. This will help expand capacity to move children more quickly out of CBP facilities. That's an important step. The implementation of that is, of course, ongoing. There's now an embedding at the president's ask of HHS and OR staff with CBP, which will allow government to more quickly ID, vet, confirm sponsors and family members of the unaccompanied minors and will lead to quicker placement placement, because as you know, or as all as you know, big issues here are expediting what's happening at the border. None of these Border Patrol facilities are made for children, and we want to move them as quickly as possible into shelters and then into homes. FEMA, this was an announcement over the weekend, is now supporting, providing support at the border, adding extra capacity to HHS for quick processing to avoid overcrowding. We hope this will help quickly get children into HHS and ORR facilities and placed with vetted sponsors and families. President's very focused on expediting what's happening at the border at every step in the process. And then this happened on Friday, but it didn't receive a lot of, there was a lot going on, so I just wanted to highlight, we rescinded the 2018 MOU between DHS and HHS, which we believe will encourage families and sponsors to come forward without fear of additional immigration enforcement. And we've seen this as an issue where family members or even sponsor families are worried that this will mean they will be tracked, and this rescinds that. That we're also looking for additional facilities, and this remains a focus. So we recognize this is a problem. We're focused on addressing it. That's just five steps we're taking, and we're continuing to evaluate what additional steps can be taken to address the situation at the border.
Back on March 5th, Psaki responded to criticism from former President Donald Trump on the Biden administration's border policy.
I know you don't want to answer to him, but the former president just released a statement saying that the Biden administration must act immediately to end the border nightmare that they have unleashed on our nation.
Former President Trump?
Yes.
We don't take our advice or counsel from former President Trump on immigration policy, which was not only inhumane, but ineffective over the last 4 years. We're going to chart our own path forward, and that includes treating children with humanity and respect and ensuring they're safe when they cross our borders.
I guess, is the plan then to take in and safely and humanely find a home for an unlimited number of unaccompanied children?
I think this issue requires us taking a step back as human beings and as mothers, of which I am one. I know there are many in the room or many at home. These kids are coming. They are fleeing prosecution. They are fleeing difficult circumstances in their home country. When they come here, all we're talking about here is ensuring that they are treated safely, they are not trafficked, they are not sent back on a unsafe journey. That's what we're talking about. When they come, when these kids come in, it doesn't mean they are ensured that they get to stay. They go through the processing system that everyone goes through. But we want to ensure that that is done by treating them humanely and with respect. Many of them will be sent back home eventually, but we're talking about how we treat them as they come in the country.
Alexandra Mayorkas, President Biden's Secretary of Homeland Security, also spoke recently on immigration and border security.
And safe to achieving and, quite frankly, are working around the clock to replace the cruelty of the past administration with an orderly, humane, and safe immigration process. It is hard and it will take time. To put it succinctly, the prior administration dismantled our nation's immigration system in its entirety. When I started 27 days ago, I learned that we did not have the facilities available or equipped to administer the humanitarian laws that our Congress passed years ago. We did not have the personnel, policies, procedures, or training to administer those laws. Quite frankly, the entire system was gutted. It takes time to build out of the depths of cruelty that the administration before us established. They need to wait. It takes time to rebuild the system from scratch. If they come, if families come, if single adults come to the border, we are obligated to, in the service of public health, including the health of the very people who are thinking of coming, to impose the travel restrictions under the CDC's Title 42 authorities and return them to Mexico. And we have done that. We need individuals to wait, and I will say that they will wait with a goal in mind, and that is our ability to rebuild as quickly as possible a system so that they don't have to take the dangerous journey, and we can enable them to access humanitarian relief from their countries of origin.
Do you believe that right now there is a crisis at the border?
I think that the answer is no. I think there is a challenge at the border that we are managing, and we have our resources dedicated to managing it.
This week, the House of Representatives is set to vote on a pair of immigration bills, one of which is the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. Earlier this month, Representatives Zoe Lofgren of California and Dan Newhouse of Washington State reintroduced the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, which they say creates a workforce solution for America's agriculture industry by providing stability, predictability, and fairness to what they call one of the most critical sectors of our nation's economy. The bill would provide a path to legal status for undocumented agricultural workers and expand the H-2A visa program. We're going to take a quick sponsor break, but there's still more to come. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRite Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
We had several interviews last week that had a lot of interest online. Here are some clips of what you may have missed. Executive Director of the California Farm Water Coalition, Mike Wade.
Well, California is in a unique position with the new administration, with Vice President Harris in office and Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, all from California. They're in key leadership positions, along with a strong California congressional delegation, to provide leadership on the investment that this country needs in water supply infrastructure. I think our leaders from California have lived through a lot of water issues, and they understand the need for reliable infrastructure for farms, homes, businesses, and the environment. And relying on their expertise and leadership can really help propel the US forward in the investment in the infrastructure that we need.
And you mentioned it here, and you also mentioned it in what you wrote, but our state leaders are uniquely equipped with water understanding because we have dealt with this for decades around California. Many of our lawmakers have been in office for quite a while, so they have dealt with it as well. How can they use those experiences now on a national level?
Well, the first thing is, I think their expertise on water issues will help the rest of the country understand that infrastructure isn't just roads and bridges and rail lines and things like that. While they're important, there isn't anything more important to our health and welfare than an adequate, dependable, and healthy water supply. And keeping that at the forefront in investments that will help people in areas like Texas, where they've had severe storms that have destroyed a tremendous amount of water infrastructure, but especially in California, which is so critical for the nation's food supply. We produce more than half of the fruits, nuts, and vegetables that are produced in the US. I mean, that's more than all the other states combined. And having a reliable infrastructure that delivers water not only supplies food for the country, it helps our economy and the jobs here in California.
This doesn't just affect agriculture, or agriculture affects everybody, but California's water issues go beyond the agricultural community. Can you give me examples of that?
Well, even a year ago, in April of 2020, Americans were surveyed, and 84%, even in as the pandemic was getting underway, 84% of those surveyed said they supported federal investment in federal investment in water supply, pipelines, canals, water treatment plants, that kind of infrastructure for water. But water supply goes beyond just the user. I mean, it enables so many other things to occur. And in California, agricultural water supply means jobs for millions of people. And it's not just farms that lose out, and we harm the farm economy if we have inadequate water supplies. It's the people that depend on farm jobs on the farm, those transportation jobs and processing that go far into the state's economy that are critical and don't exist without water supply.
And then also, and you mentioned it again in what you wrote, but when we talk about California's disadvantaged communities too, much of the nation views California still as, you know, San Francisco, Los Angeles, the big cities. But when we look at water issues through the Central Valley and we look at some of the smaller towns that were affected and people couldn't drink water, they had to have water brought in, you know, jugs and bottles. They couldn't shower for days and days. How can we work on those water issues as well with our lawmakers?
Well, there has to be a recognition that there's a tremendous population in California, 1 million people that lack access to adequate clean drinking water. 350,000 of those, more than a third of them, are in the San Joaquin Valley. And those are people that we depend on for agriculture and people that depend on agriculture for their livelihood. So we have got to invest in those small rural communities that are nearby water supplies but not connected, and find ways to get adequate, clean, healthy drinking water to those smaller communities.
We're still in a dry cycle, but there are times, you know, there are wet years in California. In the years when California gets plenty of rain and snow, what happens to that water currently?
Well, we don't have enough storage facilities to capture the water that's available during wet years. You know, we've had kind of a lackluster water year this year, but it's a reminder that we need to have infrastructure in place. We need to have dams and reservoirs. We need to have adequate groundwater storage available and the infrastructure to get water into the groundwater to make, you know, to be able to capture water when it's wet, to have it when it's dry. We experienced that just a few short years ago from 2012 through 2016 with a pretty severe drought. And you know, we're thinking maybe we're on the leading edge of another one right now. I mean, with a dry year that we're facing, unless we have a really wet March, we're going to be in dire straits, and especially in agriculture, to have sufficient water to meet those needs. So having the infrastructure there, investing in the future, I don't think there's anything better than a drought to remind us that we need to be prepared to capture water when it's wet so we have it in the future when it's dry.
Well, this will be posted on the internet so people around the nation are able to hear it. And the story of agricultural, you know, water for agriculture in California often isn't heard around the nation. What would you want people in other areas to know about California's water situation?
Well, for consumers around the nation, I think I would point out that when you go to the grocery store during certain times of the year to buy certain fresh fruit and vegetable products, they're probably coming from California. If you're buying tomato sauce or ketchup or salsa, chances are that came from California. And we play a critical role in delivering food and fiber products around the nation. And without adequate supplies, that's going to be diminished. You know, so some people say, so what? You know, there are other producers that we can rely on. But often those producers are in other countries that don't have the same safety standards, the same pesticide and health standards, the same workers' compensation, the social things that are important here in California, that we support our workers. We support our workforce. We have employment or retirement programs. There are terrific benefits that many, many farmers provide that aren't recognized here in California or around the nation. So if people care about the workers in agriculture, then they want to support domestic agriculture. And if they want safe, healthy food products, then they're going to support California agriculture because they depend on it day in and day out.
You can hear more of that in episode 26. We also talked with Protect the Harvest Board President Dale Ludwig on the move to ban rodeos in Los Angeles.
We totally agree with humane treatment, but we don't think that animals have rights like people do. They don't have souls. And so we're animal humanity, not animal rights. As far as the whole thing in Los Angeles, it's kind of one of those things where oftentimes these groups start somewhere where there isn't a whole lot of interest or people that would be against eliminating rodeos. How many rodeos are there in in LA, but it's a start. It's like the camel's nose under the tent that then leads, they go on to, you know, if you look at LA is one thing, but if you look at LA County, that is a much bigger area. And so it's just kind of a slippery slope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. This is, like you said, it's a place to start because it's an easy place to start.
Right.
Being in the city, but then there are many areas in California. I mean, Clovis, in where I'm from, has a huge rodeo, and the community loves its rodeo. What is the risk, and what have we seen in the past with other things similar to this, where the animal rights groups start in the city with something small, and then it grows? Can we see impacts from this in other areas?
Well, you know, one of the big examples is farrowing crates and gestation crates that they outlawed in Florida. You know, Florida wasn't a heavy lift because there aren't any hogs in Florida, right? But then once they get a foothold somewhere, it's easier to move to take that and use that as an example, like a leading state like Florida has decided to eliminate gestation crates, and it just kind of moves across the country then.
Right. And California, of course, has seen a couple of those, too, you know, with our eggs and things.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's what we thought was something that was interstate commerce issue. They've been able to like, uphold the requirements on egg production in other states kind of across the entire country that end up being sold in California. And once you make that change, then it's like it becomes somewhat difficult to raise a certain set of eggs for California and another set of eggs for everywhere else. So in many cases, you have a gravitation to what the rules and regulations are in California, which might not seem all that like that big a deal, other than it has dramatically increased the price of eggs. And if you happen to be like a single parent mother that is like on a limited income, eggs are one of the things that you tend to use a lot of. So it can make a big difference.
You can hear more about that in episode 28. And National Farmers Union Vice President of Advocacy, Mike Strantz, talks about the American Rescue Plan.
Throughout the pandemic and the experience of the last year, we saw how stress on our food system in the form of the pandemic just made pre-existing problems even worse. And a lot of that had to do with processing and with distribution and with our marketing chains. So this bill that President Biden signed into law earlier on Thursday will kind of take a look and provide important funding to help out with food supply chain resilience. So USDA, for instance, will be receiving $4 billion to help out in purchasing food and commodities for distribution to people in need, and to offer grants and loans to small and mid-sized processing facilities to help with their ongoing COVID response, safety, and to help be more resilient in the event something like this happens again. Another thing that'll help out, particularly on that stress that was placed on the food supply, is helping with capacity for small and mid-sized meat processing facilities. There's been some help already in previous stimulus packages, but this one includes $100 million to help pay overtime fees for inspections by federal meat inspectors at some of these small and medium-sized processing plants. And this will help scale up and get more of our livestock processed and eliminate some of the backlogs that we've seen across the country. So those are a few spots. Again, though, there's some broad-based support for increasing resiliency, assistance for people who've been affected by the pandemic, and also addresses some longstanding inequities in agriculture through loan forgiveness and debt assistance for socially disadvantaged farmers.
If we can take just a closer look at some of these points, to start off with the big one, the USDA getting $4 billion for the food system, what do you think we'll see in the trickle-down effect as that goes from the $4 billion to the USDA to benefiting our farmers around the nation?
Sure. As we saw the food system really turn on a dime last year when supply chain and demand shifts changed in ways that had taken decades to build up to, suddenly turned over in the course of weeks, there's still been some residual reverberations from that. So in conjunction with some of the legislation passed in 2020, both in the CARES Act in March of 2020 and then the package that passed late in December of 2020, this adds to that in terms of the $4 billion to help out. A lot of this will go to nutrition assistance. So USDA will be purchasing excess commodities or just purchasing commodities and farm products in order to feed and help with programs that get food to hungry people across our country. So that takes up some of that demand that's shifted and buys up some of the excess supply that we've seen in commodities, fruits and vegetables, meat, unit. So that'll help out for farmers' bottom lines with some new marketing opportunities.
Vaccine distribution, this is important everywhere, but in California, especially in the agricultural force, you know, our farm workers need access to vaccines. They are getting it now, but how will this make a difference in that effort as well?
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that. The American Rescue Plan Act includes $500 million for USDA to offer emergency grants on rural healthcare. Obviously, that's directed towards vaccination, both on distribution capacity, the surge capacity in medical facilities, increasing telehealth capabilities, reimbursement for lost revenue from the early days of the pandemic, especially when a lot of healthcare facilities were hurting because of the people were concerned to go in for more routine healthcare in light of the pandemic. In any case, getting more vaccinations out there, more shots in arms, particularly for farm workers, will be a big part of USDA's grants and what they'll be offering through that. There's still a lot of work to be done by USDA in figuring out how exactly that will happen, but the resources are being made available now through this bill or law now, and I expect in the next several weeks to the next couple of months, there'll be some fast action to get those grants out there to help get people the vaccinations that they so desperately need.
You can hear more of that interview in episode 30. We are getting in nominations for Farmer of the Week. If you know of someone we should feature, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. That's our show for today. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.